Now, creating a search engine is one of the hardest technical problems that anyone can undertake to solve. It's a little bit like saying, I'm going to build, say, like a new cell phone network from scratch. It's just hard to do. But that's what we've been doing for the past 3+ years. And obviously, things like the impact of AI on how people are going to consume information is not something, honestly, that we anticipated. But as you know, there's a lot of luck and chance in life. And so I think we have suddenly landed into the very center of what we think is going to be a giant change in how people consume information.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von Handelsblatt Disrupt, dem Podcast über neue Ideen, Disruption und die Zukunft der digitalen Welt. Mein Name ist Sebastian Mattes und ich begrüße Sie wie immer ganz herzlich aus unserem Podcast-Studio hier in Düsseldorf. Google will eine künstliche Intelligenz wie ChatGPT in Google Docs einbauen und Google Mail. Microsoft hat gerade seine neue Suchmaschine Bing gelauncht, die ebenfalls einen Chatbot hat. Und das sind nur die ganz Großen. Überall wird an dieser sogenannten generativen KI gearbeitet, an Large Language Models, die das meiste von dem, was wir aktuell mit dem Internet machen, revolutionieren werden. Dazu gehört auch die Frage, wie künftig im Internet gesucht wird. Ob das Erfolgsmodell Online-Werbung überhaupt noch funktionieren kann und ob das, was wir Redaktion produzieren und hinter den Paywalls halten, dort in Zukunft noch sicher sein wird. Einer, der die Antworten auf ganz viele dieser Fragen kennt rund um künstliche Intelligenz, ist der Mann, der jahrzehntelang die Online-Werbung für Google optimiert und dem Suchmaschinengiganten damit zuletzt mehr als 200 Milliarden Dollar pro Jahr verdient hat. Jetzt hat Sridhar Ramaswamy seine eigene KI-basierte und werbefreie Suchmaschine Niva gelauncht. Darüber spricht er heute mit unserem Korrespondenten Stefan Scheuer im Silicon Valley, den Sie ja auch schon kennen hier aus dem Podcast, und erklärt auch, warum KI-basierte Chatbots oft halluzinieren, wie Online-Werbung zukünftig funktionieren soll und was KI-basierte Suche künftig für Nutzer leisten kann.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
ChatGPT und andere Technologien verändern unsere Arbeitswelt rasant. Bei der Veranstaltung Work in Progress diskutieren wir in der Handelsblatt Media Group die Zukunft des Arbeitsmarktes, HR-Trends, KI, mentale Gesundheit und neue Leadership-Perspektiven. Sei am 13. und 14. Juni in Düsseldorf oder virtuell dabei und melde dich jetzt an unter work-progress.de.
Und damit gleich zu dem Gespräch von unserem Silicon Valley-Korrespondenten Stefan Scheuer mit dem Mitgründer und CEO der werbefreien und datenschutzorientierten Suchmaschine Niva.
Hello, Sridhar.
Hi, Stefan. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you too. So we are here to talk a little bit about the future of search. Gotcha. As you've been with Google for almost 2 decades and you decided to quit the company to start something on your own. But before we go into that, maybe take us a little bit through on what you actually did at Google.
Yeah, I joined Google in 2003 as a software engineer. I worked in the search ads team, and I actually stayed with the team for the entirety of my 16 years at Google, helped grow that team. They were already pretty successful. If I remember correctly, they made $1.6 billion of revenue, even back in 2003, which is a lot of money, but they kept growing. And so I led that team. Then I led all of the ads and commerce teams at Google. So had a bird's eye view into everything from how did publishers react to the internet, AdSense, the Google Display Ad Network, and then the rise of Facebook, the rise of mobile. It was quite the time.
So you were also responsible for exposing us to way more advertisement, have you?
That is sadly very true. It's actually a tricky thing. As you know, I'm a computer scientist and we live in a world where we think we can measure everything. And so the way ad load would go up is some very bright people from my team would go study the impact of ads. And one of them reached a surprising conclusion. He reached this conclusion that people reacted proportionally to increased ad load. In other words, if you showed them three top ads instead of two on Google search, they didn't get really mad and say, like, I'm done with search. I'm no longer going to search. I'm going to go do something else. They would just search a little bit less. They would just click on ads a little bit less. So it was more of like this like continuous phenomenon than we had accepted. So a lot of the ad load increase happens for the same time that you're seeing it, let's say on TV, because that incremental ad, it's not that bad really, but you keep doing it for 10 years. It's soon like a terrible experience. That's sort of what's happened to the internet.
Yeah, so many places, not only in Google, but in other places as well, have been dominated by ads.
That's correct.
And Google has not only been a driving force putting up ads on the search itself, but also basically increasing the number of ads that you get exposed to as an internet user also on other websites that are just using Google services.
100%. Google got into ads on third-party sites because at some level, you know, everybody at Google, including me, thought that showing ads every single place that you, Stefan, goes to is a better deal than showing you ads just where, you know, when you come to Google. It turns out that search is way more of a profitable business than helping everyone on the internet show ads. We didn't really know it then. We thought that ads outside of Google would be far, far larger. That's a little bit of a surprise. But if I were to unwind, I would say that the whole world, went through a collective delusion in the early years of this century, where we said, the tech companies didn't say this, but everybody else did. Publishers who are perfectly competent at creating great content, okay, they said, aha, if only we outsourced all the ways in which we can make money to some tech companies, we're going to be very successful. But if you think about it, that's like such a stupid idea in retrospect. But really, a lot of people basically said, I can focus on creating content and rely on other platforms to monetize. And the subsequent effect that this had on their business model is most of their traffic also became anonymous. You could just get traffic from like Facebook or Google. You didn't really need to know your customer. So I think publishers have gotten themselves into a pretty bad place where they rely essentially on anonymous streams of people coming and on ads provided by somebody else to monetize the content that they're creating. It's a very dangerous place. And we will come, to this in the context of AI and so on, where I think we are on the brink of another big change in how people interact with information. And this is going to have far-reaching consequences on publishers. Obviously, there are, many smart people around the world, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or other German publishers, I think Der Spiegel was one of them, where they said, we can't just rely on ads. We are also going to develop a more of a real relationship, more of a subscription relationship. The Wall Street Journal was firmly made fun of in the 2005-06 for not maximizing the number of people that got exposed to the content that they had. People would make fun of them for being a subscription-only search engine. Now in 2023, they look really smart.
If they can actually sustain that business model in the long run, as the interesting thing is we just looked at how the way that people use the internet worked in the past, but we're in a paradigm shift. That's where cool. Basically AI is changing that. Maybe let's look, dive a little bit deeper at this point. So you were at Google, you left the company, you joined Greylock as basically as a VC.
Right.
But you also used that to start your own company, Neeva.
Yep.
What is Neeva?
So my co-founder Vivek and I, when we left Google, we said, we love search. At a simple level, I grew up at a time when I would still go to a physical library to look up encyclopedias because I didn't have them at home. And the act of helping people find information is one that we have the simplistic attachment to. And Neeva was born out of this belief that ad-supported search had basically become like advertiser search rather than user search. and we wanted to press a giant reset button and create a better product for users. Initially, we settled on things like being ads-free, being very private, with a focus really on the user experience in order to create a much better product. Now, creating a search engine is one of the hardest technical problems that anyone can undertake to solve. It's a little bit like saying, I'm going to build, say, like a new cell phone network from scratch. It's just hard to do. But that's what we've been doing for the past 3+ years. And obviously, things like the impact of AI on how people are going to consume information is not something, honestly, that we anticipated. But as you know, there's a lot of luck and chance in life. And so I think we have suddenly landed into the very center of what we think is going to be a giant change in how people consume information.
There have been several companies, founders that tried to challenge Google over the past, I would say, 2 decades.
Yeah.
And all of them have failed so far. But there is something different about this particular point in time, as it's not only a traditional search where I would type a couple of search words and there would pop up a list of results, but AI is basically changing this game. From your perspective, what is the most dramatic change that we're going through at the moment with the use of AI in search?
So I would say that the biggest impact that AI, or as they're called, large language models, are going to have on just information in general is they're going to almost become a new way for you and me to both talk about what we want, but also to consume information. Just like it's very hard for us to imagine a world before smartphones, or imagine a world before like the keyboard and monitor. Again, it's like maybe this is in the museum, but people used to have punch cards for interacting with computers. They were slow. They took a very long time. You'd need to wait for several hours before you got any feedback. And then we went on to things that we could interact with in real time. Then came the internet, and then came the phones. To me, the real power of AI is they can understand human input really, really well. And they can take large quantities of information that we want to consume and zero in on that essential piece that you're looking for. In other words, information discovery is going to go from you typed in 2 or 3 words, you got a list of links, it's up to you to figure out which links are useful. You click on them, you browse through those pages, maybe you take notes on the side somewhere. It's a very iterative, slow kind of process. I think all of a sudden, we have the possibility that you have these models that can very concisely summarize what it is that you are looking for and just give it to you. So I think we are in the brink of moving from search being essentially a list of opaque links that you have to click to find out what is going on to first a few sentences that try to answer what you want. If you want more detail, you're able to dive in, but you're able to do all of this in a fluid way where you speak or where you type full sentences, and computers are able to understand that. Now, a lot has been said and talked about and written about like what is called generative AI, where you're interacting, say, with a chatbot, and it's just having a conversation with you like you would have with a friend about things that are not known. I think that's a whole new field. I think there is enormous potential in the creative uses of these AI models. But simply as much better input-output mechanisms, I think they're enormously powerful. For example, they're going to take search from a set of links to a set of answers. And it's not just search. When you want to, say, discover information on a place like Reddit, rather than search, you're going to interact with a chatbot that is going to tell you what it is, again, that you are looking for. And when you now begin to combine these models, not just with search as a tool, but say with other tools, whether it's an API, like a Bloomberg API for real-time information, or Wolfram for like scientific information, or a browser itself for like navigating, I think you're going to see an explosion of applications that all have the same look and feel. You talk to them, you write things to them, they take this imprecise input and they go do a bunch of things on your behalf, come back and distill down the information that you are looking for. So I think we are really looking at a huge jump, both in expectation for what users are going to want, but also in actual utility. I mean, there's like, you can always get carried away with technology, but as I said, the simplest thing is these can take like, whatever, 1,000 words and reduce them down to the 50 words that you are looking for. That's indeed a summary of the question that you have in your mind. So there's enormous power and obviously a big paradigm shift in how something like search is going to work.
ChatGPT as a product of OpenAI has basically triggered for a lot of people to engage with the technology for the first time. We saw Microsoft launching the new Bing that is basically incorporating those technologies. Do you think that this traditional search of just getting a list with different links, that this will disappear and we will be in this world where a chatbot goes out and does the research for us and just prepares an answer?
As you know, change is slow. I change is driven by utility. And things like ChatGPT, while it is magical for some applications, I've gotten to writing poetry sort of in an interactive way with these models where you tell them, oh, I want these words, I want this kind of a rhyme. They say something, you can modify it. And so there are interesting use cases. But ChatGPT has pretty big flaws, like it makes up things when it doesn't know. It does not understand what is real versus what is made up. And so the things that you expect from a search engine, that degree of authority. Obviously, if you look for obscure things, you can get obscure answers. But if you look for commonplace things, you can generally be sure that you're going to get reliable answers. ChatGPT does not have that. This is part of what Neeva is fixing. This is part of what Bing's new bot, Sydney, is fixing, where for queries, we essentially run search and AI models in parallel. So we want to create an experience that has the referenceability, that has the real-time nature of search combined with like the fluency of these AI models. So you get an answer and you also have things like references. So you can go look up where the answer came from, learn more. So this technology is also changing literally by the week. We are able to like launch really useful things for our users in a week that we would like whatever in 2020, 21 would take 3 months to launch. So just the pace of change is pretty incredible. So I think this, we are very much in the early chapters of what can AI do to information discovery.
You refer to how you want to fix the flaws in the system. I've been playing around with Neeva for a while and I came up those glitches on a regular basis. So let me just give you one example. I looked up our editor-in-chief.
Yep.
And it wrote a short summary of his CV that was correct. And then it made of weird things, such as that he had worked for the Financial Times where he never worked, that he had written several books that he hasn't. And there was a link in the bottom referring to a Wikipedia page that also contained no information whatsoever saying that he had written books or that he had been with the FT. So how do you fix those glitches? I mean, these hallucinations have been a topic in large language models for quite a while, but they have a much more profound impact if maybe only very few people are actually going to click on the link.
That's correct. That's right. So we have a process by which we do, we call it constraint generation or retrieval augmented generation, where we first fetch search results, make sure that we understand them. But we also, even over the past few weeks, we'll try this query again to see if there's that problem. So we have developed techniques over the past few weeks make sure, for example, that we cluster the results that come back. One of the problems that we ran into was that when two people have similar names, we would produce what we call this Franken summary that would have aspects of both the people. Turns out, for example, for my name, which is not that common, Sridhar Ramaswamy, not in the US anyway, there's a doctor with the same name who works like a mile from here also for Google. He works for Google Ventures. And so we would make up this, like, you know, this biography of a computer scientist and a doctor, very super accomplished person, but unfortunately not real. So there are a set of techniques that we are bringing to bear that's going to lower the incidence of problems like this. We're also looking at what we think of as like attestation techniques, where, as I said, we constrain the generation to force the models to only pay attention to the information that we set for the current query, and we tell them to not use anything else. But we are also going to add a phase, you know, by which we verify that every sentence we write is actually referenceable to the source that we say that it is attributed to. So the level of hallucination that we have is quite a bit lower than what it's on ChatGPT. But as you have played with it, there are issues that we are that we are working through.
But do you think it's solvable? Because there are also quite a few people working in the field that say, it's very, very hard to tackle that issue.
So we sort of simplify the problem considerably. And what I mean by that is we don't use language models basically in what, like, you know, what I call open loop or purely generative mode. And the reason we don't do that is because these models are basically trained on essentially large amounts of text, but no additional information. There's no epistemology in how they understand information. Every page, a page that you write, a page that I write, a page that like a fraudster write, it all looks the same to these models. They are all fed into how this model learns language. So it's able to understand linguistic structure well, but as I said, it does not understand authority. It does not understand right from wrong. And so what we are betting on is that they can become at least as reliable as search engines. Now, what this honestly, what this is exposed for us is search engines are pretty bad at lots of use cases. So for example, one of the favorite ways in which people try to trip up language models is they set up like hypothetical situations and ask the models to say something about them. So for example, one of the like early problem queries used to be, did Sridhar Ramaswamy, I don't know, win the Turing Prize? I'm not that accomplished a computer scientist. I did not. And so, but what a search engine, including Neeva, will give you today is we'll give you a bunch of pages about Sridhar Ramaswamy. We'll give you a bunch of pages about Turing Prize. But there's basically nothing that says anything about both of these concepts put together. And so a vanilla model, if you feed it this information, is just going to make up stories about whether I did or did not win the Turing Prize. So we are realizing that there is a lot of work that we have to do, even in search quality, because for the longest times, we have accepted search engines to just like know what to do in situations. And the other thing that is going on is that people are also asking many more complicated queries off of these chatbots that they would otherwise not have asked even a search engine. The other day, this person called Jason Calacanis, who runs a podcast, he typed in, how are the Knicks doing this year, into Neeva, and he was very unhappy with the answer. But to a certain extent, that's a good problem to have, because this is not a query he would ever have dreamed of putting into Google. The fact that he now says, like, oh, I can put this question and expect an answer. So there's also like a rise in expectation for what it is that people want to do. So, you know, I agree with you. There's a very long tail of very tricky issues to deal with. But just like, you know, search engines are very useful for a very large number of use cases, even though they become problematic with obscure topics, I think language models combined with search can be reliable. Over time, we will also expose, you know, other signals like are we taking information from a trusted page? Is it a New York Times page? Is it a Wall Street Journal page? Or is it some blog that you can't really be sure of? So I think things like that will make the problem better. But just like, you know, there's no friend of ours that has the perfect answer to every question that we have. It's not going to be the case that like there's going to be a tool that answers every question perfectly. And there is a little bit of an element of like you know, these tools need to know what the limits of their knowledge is. And we as humans also need to understand that, you know, there are large sets of things that are answerable in a reasonable way, but there are going to be things that are just not going to be that reliable.
So how is the internet going to change? Because if I do have a chat function in which I can gather most of the information, there is no need to actually open a website. Do we even need websites in the future?
Well, so I personally think we do, because as I said, unhinged chatbots that just talk to you and don't have external references are not very useful, simply because you never know when it's saying the truth versus when it is like purely hallucinating and making up things. So from that perspective, I think it is important. With the answers that we provide on Neeva, for example, we try to make sure that we are thoughtful about how much information we take from every page. This is also the reason why we provide citations. So I do think that the internet is going to continue to be valuable. An open question is, with the ad-supported model, if the big players, are Google and a Bing, essentially, like, you know, show answers for lots of queries, I can imagine a situation in which there can be a big change to how much traffic is going to come from these aggregators to different websites. We chatted a little bit about this. I think this is going to increase the pressure for individual websites to have a much deeper relationship with the users that do manage to come. I think currently, you know, sites like Reddit, for example, the Reddit folks know this. They know that the way they get traffic is by people appending Reddit into their search query. So if you want to know, like, you know, Sydney Bing News, you would put like Bing Sydney Reddit into a Google search box to discover the latest about Sydney on Bing. There's a very active like r/Bing subreddit on Reddit. So I think publishers have to carefully think about what is the new dynamic between aggregators and chat-like interfaces and their sites. I think it's going to go from a situation of where they expect a lot of traffic to one in which they need to work pretty hard to make sure that any visitor has a great experience, is able to find related information, that there is great search available within, you know, within the site. So I do think that there is a very broad rearrangement that is going to happen between publishers and aggregators. And on the aggregator side itself, with Google, for example, if you and I expect a perfect 80-word, 100-word answer to every query, remember that also kills the ads model. The ads model is fundamentally reliant on things like an opaque set of links and people competing to be on top. If there is one answer, there is not that much need for an ad that sits on top of that answer. And so I think that's the other impact that this is going to have. So this is a time of unprecedented change. And so I think like the user experience is going to evolve very, very rapidly.
I mean, for the aspects when it comes to advertisement, Bing has already provided one possible solution. So if you search for, I don't know, the best credit card, companies can pitch for being the first advertisement to be shown. For example, if you click on one of the links, what you get first is a link to an advertisement, and then you actually get the source link. But what I find quite interesting is the first aspect that you mentioned, which is how it's going to change the business model for a lot of content producers. I mean, we as Handelsblatt, we are the leading German business daily. And I tried, for example, some of our articles, and Neeva was able to summarize content that is behind our paywall. So Neeva was capable of circumventing the normal business model that we have to ask people to pay. And just having a snippet in today's world where I have a sentence, maybe two, maybe three, Neeva goes beyond it. Neeva can summarize the article in a way more concise way than traditional search engines do. So aren't you challenging the way that a lot of people are now producing content? Is Neeva a threat to Handelsblatt?
I mean, first, we are tiny. And the focus very much is on what is a great user experience. And we, you know, much more than ad-supported search engines have said, we exist only because the web exists. I can imagine a future. It would have to either be us growing significantly, or perhaps one of the big players, maybe an Apple, saying, here is an opportunity for a very different and very, you know, much better business model. I can imagine a scenario where similar to, say, how YouTube operates, where ads revenue is shared between content creators and YouTube, the platform itself. I can imagine scenarios in which subscription products share revenue based essentially on impression rates, based on the queries that you run, the you know, the summaries that you see. And so this is something that we've been open to since the conception of the company. And the actual, like, say, math behind this is not that complicated in terms of figuring out, you know, impression rates. I personally find that to be a healthier model focused on what is it that user want, and transparent sharing of revenue than the current ads model. A potential bad outcome for all of us is on those queries that are commercial, the big players, whether it's a Google or a Bing, keep the current ads model and force us to click on sites. But when it comes to information seeking queries, which is where you know, folks like you, Handelsblatt, makes great information, they get into more of a summarization mode. To me, that's like the worst of both outcomes. And the honest answer is I don't really think anyone has any idea about how this is all going to, like, evolve even this year. I mean, if you think about it, you know, like mid-December to mid-February, there's just so much change that has happened. So I think it is.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Wie wird unsere Wirtschaft eigentlich klimaneutral? Das ist eine der wichtigsten Fragen unserer Zeit. Und das Erste, was wir dafür loswerden müssen, sind auf jeden Fall fossile Denkweisen. In der Handelsblatt Green Innovation Week dreht sich deshalb vom 6. bis zum 10. Mai alles darum, wie die Klimawende gelingen kann und welche nachhaltigen Entscheidungen Sie jetzt für sich und Ihr Unternehmen treffen können. Seien Sie dabei, digital, im Blatt, als Podcast und live. Mehr unter handelsblatt.com/greeninnovationweek.
I think there's lots of change coming.
You mentioned a possible revenue share model. Yeah. How would that work? You said technologically it's not that difficult, but how would you actually do it?
So the simplest way to think about a revenue share model would be to say, you know, like how many queries did someone run? You know, like our model today is people pay us about $5. Maybe in this new world, it should be a different amount because it's a vastly more useful product. And then you do something like you look at the number of queries that they did and the sites that went into creating summaries, you know, for those queries. And then you basically try and say, okay, this particular card that we showed was the definitive answer for this query. And so to make the math concrete, let's say somebody ran 50 queries. That's a low amount in a month. And they pay a $5 subscription. You know, it basically tells you that it's roughly, you know, worth 10 cents per query. And perhaps there's a revenue share on each of these queries. What happens? This is basically the model that works, for example, for YouTube rev share, where there's a 55-45 rev share. That's based on essentially view time is what that is based on.
The question why I'm asking is, from my perspective, you can hardly compare it to YouTube because there you would be consuming one source. But what makes a search engine such as Neva so interesting is that I get a summary of maybe 10 different publications that have all been writing on the same topic. And you would say, those is the most interesting piece of news on this website. Here's an interesting piece that I got from this website. And I just get a concise summary of content from very different sources. So how do you evaluate those different sources?
So this is, this is an area where we are rapidly iterating on. You might have seen a feature that we did recently where we combined summarization with something we call Bias Buster. It's a way of looking at left-leaning and right-leaning news. So it'll often surprise you. I'll show you in a second. It'll often surprise you in the U.S. That when you, say, look for Ohio derailment, which is an unfortunate recent accident that has happened, right-wing news like Breitbart or Fox will present a view of what is going on that you simply cannot reconcile with what's a very left-leaning view. It's an example of how, and we can generate different summaries based on where you set a slider. You can get a centric view, or you can get a right-leaning view, or a left-leaning view.
Interesting. So I would basically say in my search query, now I just want to get hardcore left-wing or hardcore right-wing answers, or just slide the slider to the middle.
You just slide the slider to the right. We have not made it sticky, but you just slide it to the right, and we will summarize like all the right-wing news sources. It can be scary and fun. The other thing that we are working on is you can set what are called personal preferences, where you say, I prefer Handelsblatt or New York Times more than others, and we uprank them if the search quality is roughly the same. And then we want that to influence how things are summarized. So there are natural ways in which user preferences can be taken into account. So it's not the case that we generally don't want to be in the business of taking 10 different sources, especially ones that might say like somewhat different things, and then try and generate a single consistent summary out of it. I would say it's more like 3 or 4. That's the sweet spot for what these models can do well. So I can imagine a world in which user preferences are taken more into account. And these are also, the reason I set my preferences is I know I have subscriptions to a bunch of places, and my preferences are all set to them so that, you know, I prefer to read news from the places that I've already paid for, and I pay for a lot of news sources. So these are some of the different models that are possible in terms of how these summaries can work. So I think these involve questions of technology. These involve questions of what is the right thing to do. Certainly, they're also going to involve questions of what is like okay with respect to things like copyright and fair use. I think this is we are very early in a very nascent technology.
When looking at the underlying technology of large language models, you're using the BERT model from the. If I'm not mistaken.
You're not. So we train a lot of our own models. And so we don't do model research. We use typically open source models, models like Flaunt T5. We've also used some of OpenAI. We have used some of Facebook AI Research FAIR's models. We fine-tune them. We adapt them. The reason we do that is because it's a lot more cost-effective for us to run our own models rather than use external models. So we reuse a lot of research that's already been applied by folks. We are not a large language model company. We are not a foundation model company like OpenAI, but we are very good at taking technology that's been done at scale, but applying it in such a way that it's very inexpensive for us to do it. One of the issues that, say, Bing faces right now is that each query that you put in can take maybe 10 plus cents for them to run. It's a remarkably high amount of money. Just to translate that, US RPM, the amount of dollars made in advertising dollars for every 1,000 queries, used to be about $40. But if you're spending 10 cents, you know, that's like $100 you're spending just on running the system. On the other hand, we are like 2 to 3 weeks away from reducing the cost of our serving to less than a dollar for 1,000 queries.
Where are you at the moment?
So we probably are in like the $30 to $50 range. But we also use techniques like caching to lower the cost somewhat. But we want to dramatically bring the costs of these things down. And the only way we can do that is by training and running in-house models.
Do you, when looking at the providers of those large language models, how would you compare them? I mean, OpenAI is very much in the focus these days, but there have been quite a few companies that are being founded by people that actually left OpenAI during the past couple of years. So there's a lot going on in the industry. You mentioned Meta. Amazon is also working in this field, as Google is. How would you compare all of those different approaches?
Competition is good for all of us. If there's one thing that I'll take away from the last 20, 30 years, it is that having two search engines, having three cloud providers is in general a terrible deal for all of us. You don't know how consumers are going to get messed up, but guaranteed if there's one player, they'll get messed up in some fashion. It's the same reason why dictatorships never work. You don't know how, but they'll go bad. So I personally am very happy that there's so much competition with foundation models. They're rapidly approaching a size where there's like outside of the extremely specialized use cases or publishing, cutting edge papers, these models are all comparable. We work with the Anthropic team. We work with the OpenAI team. They're wonderful teams. They make wonderful products, but we are glad both of them exist. Similarly, I'm positive Google's going to have their own model. They're going to have their own API service. And then there are other players, whether it's Character, whether it's Inflection or Adept, that are also raising money to train these models. This is not to mention other people that have developed things like Stable Diffusion, which is an open source image model. They're working on a language model as well, with actually working with a German group called Eleuther. So the fact that there's lots of competition and there are lots of people making these models means that this technology will be widely applicable. There's going to be lots of competition to make sure that there are low-cost alternatives to this. As I said, at Neeva, we don't really work on model research. We want to create a great search engine. And we are proud of the fact that as a 50-person team, we actually brought a product to market at scale across a whole set of countries well before, say, Bing or Google have done with their formidable resources. Again, in my mind, this points to the need for competition, for innovation. The biggest thing that Neeva struggles with right now is not like creating a quality product. We know how to create a quality product. It's getting in front of users, getting them to actually try us, even in free mode. And then some fraction of those people decide that they're going to pay us. But it is that part of being known, getting people to try us. We are super excited about the Android choice screen, except that it's updated only once a year in June. But we're excited to be part of it because that means that more German users are going to get access to Neeva, are going to learn about Neeva. So the broad principle is I hope that the post-AI world is not the same kind of single player, two or three players kind of world as a lot of other tech fields have become over the past two decades.
Looking at the advancements in AI, for decades, people have been working on this. But during the past couple of months, we have seen one breakthrough after another. Why? Why now?
Humans cannot understand exponential scale. We just don't. What has been happening is that these models have been doubling every 5-6 months for the past 5-6 years, which means that all of a sudden they went from, in 2017, 70 million parameters for a deep learning model was state of the art. Last year, 1 trillion parameters was the state of the art. You need to go through 13 doublings. The other way of thinking about that is you need to have gone through 20 years of Moore's Law to get to a point like this. I think that's the main reason. We cannot comprehend growth at these kinds of exponential scales. I think that's the reason why these models all of a sudden have what look to be like magical properties, because people used to be experts in different sub-problems in natural language processing. All of a sudden comes a single model, which was GPT-3, was the first one to do this, that basically said, oh, we can solve all of these problems that researchers have worked on for 30, 40 years. And the answer is the same, which is this sort of exponential growth.
One of the limiting factors in training those models has been humans that were still required to a large extent till today.
Yeah.
But some companies are working on solutions where they actually do not need humans for the training purposes any longer. So do you think this exponential growth is going to continue?
I think we're reaching the limits of what can be done with exponential growth. As I said, at Neeva, we prefer to be one or two generations behind because we can get the same quality as the big models for specific problems, spending a fraction of the money that that these folks have to put in. As I said, for specialized applications, I think you will see these models do magical things. But we've also adopted this technique of taking training data generated by very large models and using them to train smaller models for specific problems that that we have. It's incredibly cost efficient for us. And more these models are becoming what is called token limited, which is there's just not enough text in the world to make the models learn more. It turns out there's a relationship between how much training data you need to give to a model, even if it is just pages on the internet, and the size of these models. There are not that many pages on the internet, so we are reaching limits for what is it that these models can learn. I personally think that tool use and training models to use tools effectively, whether it's search engines or APIs or browsers, I think that is going to be an area of big breakthroughs. And they use a different set of techniques than the ones that, you know, we have applied so far at scale to train larger models. But it's very early and very exciting.
Just to wrap things up, those large language models do not only impact written language, what we talked about, but they also impact the production of pictures, of music, of videos. So what are you most excited about? You have quite a great overview of the entire scene. Is there something particular that you had a wow moment recently?
I would say, for example, the quality of image generation, the quality and sophistication of video generation. I think it's mind-boggling how much progress is being made. Obviously, we are a language company, and we are very excited by what these models can do for language. But I think there's a whole bunch of really exciting use cases, also slightly depressing ones. I tell people Michael Jordan is going to ask you to buy his shoes soon. It'll be an ad that's personalized for Stefan. I don't know who your favorite player is. Maybe it's Ronaldo telling you to buy their shoes. So I think there's going to be interesting applications. I'm not like, you know, I'm not a blind believer in tech. I think of tech as a tool, and I think it has to be used carefully. It has to be used responsibly. And so I think AI offers a lot of opportunity. But as you know, like we do have to worry about things like biases in these models. ChatGPT, for example, will not write poems about Donald Trump, but it will write poems about Joe Biden. And the weird part is they have no idea why. It's like, oh, yes, I guess that's how the models were trained. That's funny, except you know some people don't find it funny. But now imagine that these models are then deciding whether you or I should get a home loan. Suddenly it's not so funny anymore. So I think there's a lot that we have to learn about how these models can be trained to not have biases, trained you know, and used in responsible ways. So speaking about the image models, I was generating images. And, you know, whenever I generated impressionist paintings, only white people would show up. And so if you try to change the prompt to get like, you know, people from India or people from Africa, the people would disappear. And so it's just like these are hidden biases in how these models got trained. So there's a lot that we have to be thoughtful about, mm-hmm. especially for broad applications.
You described how advertisement conquered the internet, how you actually played a role in this. Just looking at the example that you just gave of Michael Jordan asking you to buy his shoes, how big is the risk that we're at the beginning not of like a bright future, but a dystopian ad-ruled, generated hell?
Well, this is where what we do matters a lot. How you exercise choice. For example, you know, my phone beeped a couple of times in our conversation. That's the opposite of how I use my phone. I turned it on only because I was expecting you to come here. I don't have any notifications turned on anywhere ever in my life because I want to be in charge of how I lead my life. My younger son, for example, refuses to have a smartphone. He actually has a flip phone because he's like, hey, I use my phone.
Wow. How old is he?
He's 22. He's
old.
Yeah. He's okay. Like, you know, I want to be in charge of my time. I don't want my phone to decide what I do. He has a smartphone in his room, but the phone that he has is a flip phone. So I think we all have to be careful about things like our attention, our agency, where we put our time. I think the onus is going to be even higher now compared to before.
Thank you so much for all your time. That was super interesting.
Thank you, Stefan. That was good.
Und damit sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende von Handelsblatt Disrupt. Wie immer freue ich mich über Kommentare in der Handelsblatt Disrupt LinkedIn-Gruppe oder senden Sie mir gerne eine Mail. Die Details finden Sie in den Shownotes. Danke an dieser Stelle auch für die Unterstützung von Lukas Teppler und Regina Körner und Migo Fecke von professionalpodcast.com, dem Dienstleister für Strategieberatung und Podcastproduktion. Wenn Sie grundsätzlich immer auf dem Laufenden sein wollen, dann testen Sie doch gerne unser Handelsblatt-Vorteilsangebot. Damit lesen Sie die aktuellen Artikel plus alles aus dem Archiv für 4 Wochen für nur 1 Euro. Schauen Sie doch einfach mal nach unter handelsblatt.com/Mehrwirtschaft. Die Details dazu finden Sie in den Shownotes. Wir hören uns dann nächste Woche Freitag wieder. Bis dahin wünsche ich Ihnen interessante digitale, aber natürlich auch analoge Zeiten. Ihr Sebastian Mattes.
Willkommen in der Zukunft der Technologie mit dem Handelsblatt Summit Zukunft IT. Seien Sie Teil der IT-Flagship-Tagung des Handelsblatts, bei welcher führende Köpfe der IT-Branche zusammenkommen, um die neuesten Trends und Herausforderungen der digitalen Transformation zu diskutieren. Vernetzen Sie sich mit Branchenführern und finden Sie Lösungen, die Ihr Unternehmen voranbringen. Exklusiv für unsere Podcast-Hörer sichern Sie sich jetzt 20% Rabatt auf Ihre Anmeldung. Besuchen Sie zukunft-it.jetzt und verwenden Sie den Vorteilscode PODCAST.